Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of January. For the first time in a whole lot of years, some 70 years, the Food and Drug Administration has released requirements for improving food safety. Last Friday, the FDA released two draft rule proposals for safety that will allow the agency to shift its focus to preventing rather than simply reacting to foodborne illnesses. And the number of foodborne illnesses in this country is really quite substantial. There are indications that 1 in 6 Americans suffer from a foodborne illness every year. 130,000 are hospitalized and 3,000 die from their illness. So preventing foodborne illness would, of course, improve public health and the lives of many Americans. We have two guests with us this hour to talk about these FDA rules and answer the overall question of how we make our food safer in this country. James Marsden is with us. Professor Marsden is at Kansas State University, where he is with the Animal Sciences and Industry Program. He is a professor of meat science, and his research focus has been on the safety of meat products. This includes the control of E. coli in raw ground beef and other processed beef products, and listeria in processed meats. He serves on the advisory boards for companies that provide food safety technologies to the meat industry. James Marsden, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Also joining us is David Plunkett. He is senior staff attorney for the Food Safety Program at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Before this work, he served as legislative director and counsel to U.S. Representative Bart Gordon of Tennessee. David Plunkett, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, well, thank you, Kathleen. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, nice to have both of you with us. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Now, from what I've read, I don't know if this is right or not. Let's start with you, David. Press reports indicate that it's been a long, long time since the FDA has released requirements or made requirements for improving food safety. We haven't paid very much attention to this for 70 years. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that's the statutory authority. 1938 is when the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was passed, and there haven't been a lot of amendments to that over the years. This is the first major amendment to that. But FDA has been active with the authority that they had from 1938 and the things that have been done since to try and improve safety. And they have implemented some programs. One is seafood, the seafood HACCP program, which was, bringing a preventive program to the seafood area. And basically what they have now is authority to expand that to all foods.
Mm-hmm. And what about in the area of meat? Have we had regulations? Has it been monitored carefully or not, James?
Of course, FDA doesn't regulate the meat and poultry industry. That's USDA. And USDA, back in the 1990s, issued their own regulations, which in many ways are similar to the regulations that FDA announced earlier this week. Like David says, they're HACCP-based regulations. HACCP is an acronym that stands for Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Point. It is a preventative system. So the meat industry has been under that system by regulation now for a number of years. Interestingly, Michael Taylor, who is at FDA now and was instrumental in developing these regulations, also developed the meat regulations back in the 1990s when he was Undersecretary for Food Safety at USDA.
So are these changes then, for the first time, the FDA will be looking at testing for E. coli in beef as well as the areas they already control, or is this new for the FDA?
No, it's really not that so much. That still remains at USDA. What FDA is doing is they're adopting the same kind of preventative requirements that USDA has had in place for some time now, so that every manufacturer of food products that are and the whole rest of the food industry is regulated by FDA will have written food safety plans that assess the risk associated with the food products that these companies are producing, And also, they will include preventative measures that these companies will put in place, if they haven't already, to either reduce or eliminate the risk of foodborne pathogens and other food safety-related hazards in all of those food products. So it's really an extension of what USDA has already done. There's about 8,000 or 9,000 meat plants in the United States that are federally regulated. There's 30,000 to 40,000 FDA-regulated food plants. So it's a very large expansion of this preventative system to include all food products.
I see. Tell me how substantial, David, foodborne illness is in this country. Is it a cause of great concern?
Yeah, it is. You covered the numbers. The estimates are that about 48 million people will suffer a foodborne illness in any given year. And, that's a substantial number. It's one in six, as you said. And so there is that. And it imposes a substantial cost on society. The estimates are that it's about $78 billion just in health care and lost productivity on the part of the people who get sick and the families. But it also imposes a cost on industry, because one of the things we've seen is that when there's an outbreak in a food commodity, it doesn't just affect the company that caused the problem. It affects all of the companies. And so, my example has always been the spinach industry that suffered a $350 million loss
Ooh.
In sales. Simply because of the outbreak that occurred in 2007 in bagged spinach, and that was associated with spinach from a single farm. So I can tell you that there are economic consequences, there are health consequences, and some of them are not really quantified, because for example, salmonella can lead to lifelong health problems such as reactive arthritis and other illnesses that can reduce the quality of life for people who suffer maybe a mild bout of salmonella early in life and then find themselves facing lifelong difficulties.
Mm-hmm. Professor Marston, our food now comes from all over the world. Our meat and our produce comes from everywhere. Do these regulations, are there regulations in place? Will these regulations add to the steps that other countries will have to take to make sure the food is safe that's distributed everywhere in the world?
Eventually they will. These are the first two regulations we've seen that resulted from the Food Safety Modernization Act, which was signed into law about 2 years ago. And these first regulations address these preventative written food safety plans, or will require those, and also they'll require science-based production practices for fruits and vegetables here in the United States. But we will see additional regulations in the future that specifically address the issue you brought up, and that is foods that are produced by other countries. You're exactly right. We import far more food into the United States than we have historically, and food is coming from Mexico, South America, Asia. And eventually, all of these companies in these various countries around the world will have to comply with the same standards that U.S. food companies operate under. So it's a very ambitious act, and a far-reaching indeed when you think about all the food companies and all the farms and so on all over the world, really, that export food to the United States.
David, do we know what prevents foodborne illness?
It's a lot of it is just, the kind of caution you would anticipate a business that's producing food or a farm would take. It's things like, preventing contaminants from arriving on the food in the case of a farm. So, you want to be sure you've composted the manure so that it's not going to carry E. coli to your plants. You're going to want to make sure that your water is not contaminated with salmonella, that any kind of facilities that you might have on your farm are far enough away from the fields that they're not going to cause contamination. And that the workers wear gloves and have hand washing facilities, that sort of thing. And then in the plants, what you're going to be looking at are things like, HACCP, or that concept that's being used here, which is, a hazard analysis where you look at what are the likely hazards with the particular food I'm producing. And then you establish where are there critical control points in the production of that food where I can control that hazard. And so you might have something like a cooking step, or you might have a step where you wash the product and make sure that it's not carrying any kind of contaminants that might have arrived in the in the plant from the fields or wherever the food is coming from. So there's steps. They're usually pretty well known. A lot of companies already employ these techniques and make sure that they're that their plants are kept sanitary and that they're meeting the health standards that that we would anticipate they're going to take.
Do you want to add to that at all, or is that a pretty complete list, James?
Well, it's complete, but I think the power in terms of controlling these, especially microbiological pathogens, are in the interventions that are used by companies in processing plants. David hit on one, which is a very effective one, and that's cooking. If products are pasteurized, like heat pasteurized milk, the risk of foodborne disease pretty much goes away. A lot of foods, unfortunately, don't have a pasteurization step. We've talked about spinach. You can wash spinach, bag spinach, but it's difficult, at least at this point, to have a pasteurization technology. So that, in cases like that, we're relying on other types of interventions, which it may include something like ozone washing or washing in a dilute chlorine solution. But there are a lot of intervention choices that are out there available to the industry, and technology providers are adding to that list every year. So new interventions are being developed, new and more effective interventions.
Considering what both of you do for a living, I'm wondering, and you can answer this honestly, please, if there are certain foods when you go grocery shopping that you check the label pretty thoroughly, or there are certain foods that you just stay away from because you're concerned there's not effective regulation. David?
Yeah, I don't know if I would answer, about a concern about effective regulation. I'm hoping that the new rules will solve whatever issues there may be there. But there are foods that carry a higher risk than other foods, and we've known that for some time. And, it's things like sprouts. Sprouts have a high risk for carrying E. coli. And, in fact, in the past year, we've had at least one outbreak, and I'm sure there have been other instances. Fish has a higher rate of illnesses than some other foods. Any kind of protein, particularly protein that you might eat raw, like as sushi, carries a higher risk, and so you need to be careful. And, we've learned things like cantaloupes can carry some serious problems. We've had an outbreak from salmonella in cantaloupes, and then if you remember about a year ago, we had an outbreak of listeria with cantaloupes, and I think that was one of the first instances where I'd heard of listeria on cantaloupes. So those are two serious pathogens, and it's the products one is products that you might eat raw. You've got to be careful about those, and it's also any food that you might cook. Is, of course, a risk of cross-contamination, and so that's things like chicken. If you undercook chicken, there's a risk, but also if you use the same knife to cut the chicken that you cut your salads with, then you're likely going to transfer, the contaminants on the chicken onto the salad, so it creates its own risk there.
Mm-hmm. Professor Marston, how about you?
I don't really avoid foods, but I'm careful about foods. David mentioned cantaloupe. I always rewash cantaloupe very carefully, and even scrub it with a brush. Because of just the nature of cantaloupe, it's very hard to get clean in a processing plant, microbiologically clean. So sometimes bacteria get into the reticulated surface of the cantaloupe, and it's hard, and then when you slice it, it gets onto the inside surface. And if you store it in a refrigerator or in a cabinet for a few hours, it might grow to dangerous levels. So if cantaloupe is a good example, I wash it. Fruits, I wash. Berries, I microwave for a few seconds.
Really?
I do, because it kills any bacteria that might be on the surface just for a few seconds. I don't cook them, just long enough to inactivate mold spores or bacteria that might be on the surface of the berries. You really can't wash berries or it ruins their shelf life, so I use a microwave. So I do a little bit more preparation for certain foods that might pose a higher risk. And David's exactly right. These are the raw foods that aren't highly processed, where if contamination does occur, there's really no kill step involved in the process all the way through processing and consumption.
Do these regulations include money for people to check on the hundreds of thousands of farms and plants all over the world that are giving us our food? How do we know everybody's complying with all of this?
That's a really good question. And, I've worked up here. You mentioned that I worked for a congressman, and so it's kind of the way the legislative system works. You do the authorizations, which is what gave the agency the power to issue these rules, but then you do a separate appropriations bill to provide them with the money. And a lot of times those two things don't meet up. Right now, FDA is certainly, to implement these rules, they will certainly need additional funding. And I know that FDA is not being shy or not being stingy with its funding that it has, in that they are providing assistance to the states to try and get them up to speed, and also there are plans to do things to help the processors and the farmers understand their responsibilities and meet them under these new rules. So, the idea is money is, it's there conceptually, but it's going to depend on Congress appropriating the dollars and local state legislators appropriating the dollars to carry out the food safety program.
Mm-hmm. What about in the meat industry, James Marston?
Well, Congress does provide extensive funding for USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service. The USDA has far more inspectors than FDA. They're operating under a different statute. They're operating under primarily the Meat Inspection Act or Poultry Products Inspection Act. And they have inspectors in meat plants pretty much around the clock. So they're very heavily inspected, and Congress does provide funding for that. FDA has far fewer inspectors, just a few hundred, I believe. And their whole philosophy is different. They set up requirements and then go in periodically, maybe once a year, even once every 2 or 3 years, and check records to make sure that companies are complying. So FDA has a completely different philosophy of inspection. Now, I understand, and David can chime in here, but I think that there's some plans to have a registration fee for food plants that are regulated by FDA that will provide additional funding for FDA to implement these regulations, both here in the United States and around the world. I don't think that's quite been sorted out yet, but I believe that's the plan.
Yeah, there's a proposal out there to try and create some additional funding. I mean, your issue here in Washington is that there's a feeling we've got all the revenues we're going to get, and so you've got to make the government fit within those revenues, and that's going to make it difficult to shift money into the food safety area and still provide funding for the other things government does. But one solution that's been proposed is to create this user fee, which would be, when you register your food plant, you would pay a small fee for that, just like you're going to pay a license to, a business license locally. And that money would then be used to support the inspection program at FDA. I will add one thing. FDA has about 2,700 inspectors who are focused on the food area, but some of those inspectors also get used for the drugs and medical devices that FDA also regulates. And so the inspection rates currently, FDA may see a plant maybe once in 10 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's been a problem. They've been improving lately. But under the new law, they're supposed to get in and see the high-risk food plants at least once every 3 years, and the other food plants at least once every 5 years. And, of course, that's where the question you had earlier about the money comes in. Will Congress appropriate the dollars, or will we create some sort of fee system to support the number of people you're going to need to do those inspections?
How many do we need?
It's a good question. 2,700 doesn't quite get us there. I know Dr. Marston said he thought it's about 30,000 to 40,000 food facilities that FDA inspects. It's actually about 65,000 to 70,000 that are considered interstate food facilities. Then there's probably another 100,000 that are intrastate, which means that they just sell within the state where they're located. And on top of that, you've got something like 230,000 foreign food facilities that supply food to our country. So it gives you kind of a scope of the problem that the agency faces, and and what the need is for additional revenue, additional resources, and additional people to do the inspections that are going to be required.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take phone calls for both our guests. We're looking at food safety. The Food and Drug Administration proposed safety rules that will aim to prevent foodborne illnesses, and we're talking with David Plunkett, Senior Staff Attorney for the Food Safety Program at the Center for Science and the Public Interest. Professor James Marston is a professor of food safety and security at Kansas State University. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I guess the big question of the hour is, do you feel that most of the food that you buy and consume is pretty safe? Are you pleased with these proposals from the food and from the FDA, Food and Drug Administration? Do you think we have enough inspectors? What about the whole system that's in place to protect our food? We welcome your phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, this came to our attention when we did this that program on New Year's Day, I think. No, on New Year's Eve. Popular Science magazine predicted the recent work of the Non-Human Rights Project would be one of the leading science stories of 2013. We're going to be talking with the president of that organization about their plans to procure freedoms for certain animals, highly intelligent animals like elephants and chimpanzees and dolphins, rights that were previously granted only to humans. It should be an interesting conversation. All right, we go to phone calls, 800-486-8655, the safety of our food, how to prevent foodborne illnesses, the role of the FDA, particularly because it's been in the news last week and this week, and we'll welcome calls starting with Jack in Madison. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Yes, I'm concerned that these rules tend to favor large agribusiness, and they put the smaller operator, which Wisconsin is mostly small operators, at a disadvantage. And I'm wondering if they've codified any way to protect the smaller people and the people that we might meet at the farmers market, et cetera.
All right. Who wants to take that? James, David?
Oh, this is David. And, yeah, I was going to say, you know, that's one of the issues that came up during development of the Food Safety Modernization Act. There was a lot of concern about the small farmers and about the small processors, about local food. I know the Center for Science and the Public Interest, anyone who knows us knows that we've got kind of two sides. We've got a nutrition side as well, and strongly favor, nutritious eating, and have done a lot of things with the local food and local food movement. So we kind of share that concern. But if you look in the law, there are requirements for the processors. There are requirements that FDA issue rules that are flexible and can be applied that don't require people to go out and hire a third party to figure out what their responsibilities are. And there's also provisions of what are commonly called the Tester Amendment, which is a provision for small manufacturers that allows them to do a simplified program or simply confirm that they comply with state law. As long as they're selling locally and selling direct to consumers, they don't have to do the more extensive programs required by the Act. And there are also some provisions to assist farms that have processing plants and doing small processing who will also be able to claim an exemption from the rules. And if you look at what FDA has released, they released also a risk assessment that they are doing to see who would be, who that would be applicable to. And that's on the processor side. On the farm side, the language is really specific that FDA has to look at the environmental rules, make sure that there's no contradictions with environmental rules that farmers are supposed to follow, look at the organic farming rules, make sure that there's no duplication or contradictions with the organic rules, and be flexible enough that small farms and large farms can apply the standards. And on top of that, there's also, again, a tester provision that says that if your farm is smaller than, I think it's 500,000 in sales, and you mostly sell to local consumers directly, then the rules are not going to apply to you. Instead, you will abide by state laws and state rules, and of course, good practices will be important. And so, there's been a lot done. Congress took that very seriously, and there's been a lot done to make sure that we protect the local producers and the local suppliers, and make sure that they're able to do things and to implement safety in their operations without having to bear, an excessive burden of cost to do that.
Mm-hmm. James, did you want to add something here?
Well, there are still a lot of small processors that will come under this act and these regulations. And ideally, they won't have to go out and hire, a PhD-level food safety expert in order to comply. One of the things that I'm at Kansas State University, so we do a lot of outreach to small processors in our state, and I also work with the trade association that does the same nationally. So small processors do have access to university extension specialists and other experts that are in the university systems in every state in the United States. So they do have access to expert assistance. I know that FDA did, in Congress, pay a lot of attention to the impact of this act and regulations on small businesses, but I don't think it's right to underestimate the fact that they will have to comply, most of those, especially small processors, and it will require a considerable effort on their part.
Yeah, and the bottom line, just to echo what Dr. Morrison's saying, the bottom line is that you are still, you're under the statutory requirement not to ship adulterated food. And one of the other things, Dr. Marston makes very clear, and it's also in the statute, there are a lot of provisions for assistance that are going into this. And, I think the extension services and the, and the universities that are doing the food safety work and working with the local folks, are a critical component in how we're going to get not only, compliance, but also get a safer food supply, which is really the goal.
Right. Jack, thanks for the call. Anita in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. I am very concerned about something that I see more and more of. And what it is that a lot of the large chains, when they have their own brand, like Walgreens and Target, they have their own brands of things. When you look on the packaging, it tells where it's distributed, but it does not say where it's manufactured. And I think that's intentional because a lot of those big box stores, they do use, what we would term slave labor in other countries. And the manufacturing in those countries is not as pristine as it might be if it were here or in Germany or in Canada. How can we get those labels for the common consumer to say where it's actually manufactured? I'm talking food products.
All right, David?
Yeah. Labeling for where the food originates is an important issue. And, one of the things we've worked on are appropriate labels so that people can understand what they're buying, what its nutrition value is. And we've also done some work on things like, programs that require the require certain products to carry carry the name of the country where it might be imported from. And we worked on that. One of the things in this statute is a traceability requirement for this. It will only apply to high-risk foods, but it's going to require the food to carry a label that's going to say where it comes from so that people can trace it back. And we'll have to wait and see how the agency implements that. But certainly being able to know where your food comes from is important because I think there are different issues with different countries. The Anita raised labor as one of the issues, and that's a, you know, kind of a social concern. But you also have issues. Certain countries are well known for, you know, allowing the use of chemicals in the production of their food that we don't allow. And so you need to be aware of that. And there can be pathogens that are specific to certain regions of the world that you might want to be aware of as you consider a choice between two different food items.
Hmm. Thanks, Anita, for your call. A couple lines are open. If you've been trying to reach us, now would be the time to do so. 800-486-8655. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're talking about the FDA proposing new food safety rules that will attempt to prevent foodborne illnesses. We have two guests with us, David Plunkett, who was just speaking, senior staff attorney for the Food Safety Program at the Center for Science in the Public Interest, and James Marston, professor of food safety and security at Kansas State University, is also our guest. His research focus has been on the safety of meat products. 800-486-8655, our number. Don is our next caller in West Salem. Hi, Don.
Morning.
Good morning.
Yes, my question is about this fracking that they're doing with getting natural gas out of the ground. Do you have any control over that, or have any input as far as if they would rupture the underground aquifers, as to what it would do as far as polluting the food?
David?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It kind of brings an issue that I had not given much thought to. I mean, fracking is really kind of, you know, it's Interior Department, not FDA, and it's also, you know, an issue for, you know, the Energy Department. But, yeah, he raises an interesting point, and that is that one of the things that in the processor side you are supposed to do is you're supposed to rate what are the likely hazards. And I imagine if you could show that there would be a, you know, a potential hazard that if, you know, contaminated water were used to produce the product that you are manufacturing, that you might have to consider, you know, is, you know, does my water come from an area where fracking has caused, you know, contamination? And for farmers, I imagine, you know, for irrigation water, they might have to consider it. But I don't know what the evidence is for contamination of aquifers and whether or not that's that's something that will be a focus of these rules when they become effective in a few years.
Mm. We just saw the film Promised Land, Matt Damon's film on the fracking issue over the weekend. It's a pretty serious film. I don't know if either of you have seen it. I don't know if this will add to the national debate on this. It may not be a huge moneymaker or widely seen because it is such a serious film. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it.
You have, Professor?
I have not, not yet.
No, I have not.
You have
I live
not.
In Manhattan, Kansas. It'll probably be a while before it gets here.
You never know. All right, thank you very much, Don, for your call. This one goes to you, Professor Marston, because you brought this up. Diane emailed us to say, microwaving berries? Fascinating. Please tell us more specifically how long you microwave them to kill microorganisms without cooking the berries. For a pint of strawberries for a few seconds? You mean 5 seconds? 10, 30? And then how does this work? They're not getting hot enough to kill bacteria in the same way that we heat other foods to temperatures like, say, 160 degrees to kill bacteria.
Right, right. Well, what I do for small packages of berries like blueberries and raspberries is 10 to 20 seconds. And for strawberries, which come in larger containers, maybe up to 30 seconds. So it's certainly not cooking anything. It doesn't even really raise the temperature. What I'm doing is just killing bacteria and really mold spores more than is more of the focus than bacteria that are on the surface of berries. And they're very susceptible to microwaving. And it doesn't activate them. I think if your listeners try this, they'll see that their berries last much longer. They don't develop mold spores the way they do otherwise.
Hmm. All right. Joanne is next. Hi, Joanne.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I'm wondering, does this new legislation do anything to restrict or test the safety of genetically modified organisms? And also wondering, shouldn't these companies that are producing GMOs or using them in their products be required to label these products? As a consumer, I just feel it's our right to know what we're eating.
Thanks for the call. Whoever would like to address that,
that's
speak
for David.
David?
yeah. This doesn't deal with GM, and I think it's primarily concerned with microbiological pathogens, chemicals, and and anything else that might be added to the food. As far as labeling, it's a good question. Should they have to label GM? And I think that that's something that will be addressed in other legislation and addressed in in a different fashion, because the issue you're raising there is different from the specific food safety issue that's dealt with in this law.
I'd like to chime in on that just
sure.
briefly, though, and say that in general, consumer labeling is usually turns out to be a very good thing for everybody. It seems like food companies get in the most trouble when they, for some reason, refrain from labeling something or other. And consumers seem to be pretty accepting of just about anything as long as they have a choice and they're informed about what's in a food and how that food might be processed. So in general, labeling disclosure seems to me to be a pretty good idea.
Patricia in Baraboo is next. Hi, Patricia.
Yes, I'm very concerned about the confined animal factory farms and feel like I want to shy away from, or I am shying away from, purchasing anything when I'm wondering if it might be from there. I can't imagine that, from what I know, that it's good for the animals or our safety or the environment. And I would really love it if that could be labeled in some way. I just don't think it's going to be self-sustaining in the future.
Professor Marston, what do you think?
Yeah, there's a whole movement going on in the animal food industry to improve conditions for animals throughout the whole process. There's a colleague of mine at Colorado State University, Temple Grandin, who has really led the charge on improving animal welfare conditions across the industry. And it's something that has caught on. A lot of customers, fast food restaurants and retailers are pushing for better conditions for animals during the various stages of animal production. So this is something that I think the industry has very definitely taken note of, and not just the animal production industry, but also their customers as well. And I think we're going to see great strides in the future, and already are seeing that in the way that animals are raised for food.
Do we see, I don't know if anybody's done, maybe your organization has, David, study of where foodborne illnesses come from. Is there any evidence that factory farms may create more of these kinds of illnesses or not?
Well, I think that the difference is that a factory farm is producing a lot of product. And so, if you're buying lettuce that was raised on a large farm, well, that lettuce has probably gone to more places than if you were buying, say, a small kind of family farm. And so, as far as the issue of is it more likely to be or less likely to be contaminated, there are a lot of considerations you have to look at. I think the initial contamination is probably, it's the same risk regardless of the size of the farm. And then you have to look at the practices and you have to look at the things that the farm has done to try and prevent those, prevent the contamination. And in some regards, large factory farms may do a better job, but because they sell more product, they end up causing, more public illnesses. At the same time, the small farms are just as capable of producing safe food and good food. So, it's a toss-up question.
Thanks, Patricia, for your call. We'll take more in just one moment. We're talking about how to prevent foodborne illness and the new regulations proposals from the FDA last week. Our guest are James Marston, professor of food safety and security at Kansas State University, and David Plunkett, senior staff attorney for the food safety program at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655 and email talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, you'll want to stay tuned for this. It should be very interesting. Stephen Wise will join us, president of the Non-Human Rights Project. This is a project that includes all kinds of people. He is a lawyer from Boston University. He teaches animal rights jurisprudence. Dr. Jane Goodall is also a member of this organization. And what they're doing is that they are going to be looking at legal rights for certain kinds of animals that are not human, animals that show a great deal of intelligence, like elephants and parrots and dolphins. What are the legal rights that the Non-Human Rights Project is demanding for non-human animals? And we'll be looking at that and the intelligence of some non-human animals and which animals they focused on and what it would mean for those animals. Should be a fascinating conversation. And that's after 10 o'clock today. This hour, the safety of our food supply and the major requirements for importing food safety and for preventing foodborne illness and examining the places where our food comes from to make sure that they are up to par is our focus of conversation. And we go to Greg next in Madison. Hi, Greg.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been involved in the meat industry for quite some time and currently in the pet food industry. The standards that FDA is going to be applying not only to human food but also to pet food, do you see that the humanization of pet foods, that the same kind of standards are going to be applied to pet food plants are going to be similar to those of human consumption type plants? And okay, is the FDA...
Okay, who wants to take that?
Okay, well, I've been working in that area, so let me try it first.
Good.
And to specifically answer your question, the regulations that apply to human food will also be equally applied to pet foods.
Mm.
So pet foods will come under the same exact standards as human foods. And part of the rationale for that is because there have been cases of human foodborne disease associated with pet foods, not so much that humans are eating pet foods, but they're handling pet foods when they feed their pets.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're contaminated with salmonella or some other pathogen, there's a risk that humans might contract a disease from that. So that's the reason, the primary reason that FDA is including pet foods. Dogs especially aren't really susceptible to salmonella, so it's not really an issue of making the pet sick, although there have been other hazards that did indeed cause illnesses in pets and deaths in pets, so those will also be addressed under the Food Safety Modernization Act. But for the pet food industry, and I've been working also with the pet food industry quite a lot recently, they're looking at a major change in requirements. They're going to be operating under the same basic regulations as human food.
Hmm. David, did you want to add anything?
No, I think Dr. Marston's absolutely
okay.
Right. And the instance that I think about with pet food is the melamine contamination back in, several years ago. And you'll recall what an outcry that was.
Yes.
People really care a great deal about their pets, and
mm-hmm.
so you want to make sure that the pet food industry is meeting some high standards as well.
Did you
Michael
have something
Taylor,
else? Greg, did you have something else?
Yes, I guess when it comes to E. coli and raw pet foods, dogs and I guess animals are carnivores and are better able to handle let's say E. coli. That is something that with human consumption there's tolerances as to 0157 E. coli and for humans, but dogs are much more tolerant of that particular bacteria. Is there a move to eliminate that to a human standard as well?
Yeah, it'll the same standard for salmonella and E. coli 0157-87 will apply to pet food. And again, the issue is not that anybody thinks that pets are particularly susceptible to these pathogens. It's just that when you bring contaminated pet food into your home and then you're handling it, maybe your kids are feeding the pet or whatever that might be, if it is contaminated, there's a risk that the person handling the food might become infected.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Greg, for your call. Kathleen in Janesville, hi.
Hi. That caller called earlier and talked about the way packaging is done. And it's unreal how it fools the public with pictures of farms, and then it says distributed by, and then you look way down on the bag and it says a product of chili. I've seen that a lot in stores. I've even, when I'm shopping, if I see somebody with small children and they're buying something, I tell them to please read your labels. I'm a label reader.
I guess you are.
I buy organic, uh-huh, and the will say, from the USA and Mexico. And I said to the guy, well, is the packaging from Mexico? I mean, from the USA? And what's in it is from Mexico? You know, that doesn't make any sense.
David Plunkett.
Yeah, and with the organic question, you've also got to look at, is it certified organic or is it just saying it's organic? And those, you know, there's a difference. One of them is telling you that it was actually raised to certain standards, while the other one is sort of a self-described product. So labeling is important. It's there for a reason, and it's to help consumers understand what they're buying and to know that it is what they want to buy. And so I agree that you know, the packaging should be done in a way that people understand what they're reading. It shouldn't be there to deceive them in any way. And you know, and of course, there you might be getting over into Federal Trade Commission rather than FDA with regard to food packaging.
Thanks, Kathleen. David in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
Hi there. I had two questions. My first one is, how do these microbiological pathogens begin? Because farmers use manure for fertilization, but it's not obviously all contaminated with these pathogens. Where does it get its beginning?
All right. Professor Marston?
All right, I'll try that. Well, of course, there's different kinds of pathogens, and they have different origins. One of the most significant associated with fruits and vegetables is Listeria monocytogenes, which just naturally occurs in soil. So it makes people sick, but it resides in soil, and it's very easily transmitted onto the surface of fruits and vegetables and other products, too, just by carried on dust particles and so on.
Hmm.
Some of the other pathogens are what's called enteric pathogens, are associated with animals, and that would include salmonella and pathogenic E. coli. And the source of those would be really animals or fecal contamination from animals. And it's, you know, you think about manure fertilization, but also these are carried just in dust particles. So if you have farming going on where you near a place where you have cattle, you can just have bacteria carried by dust or by insects and birds and various vectors. So they just exist in nature. It's very hard to produce food, raw food, that's pathogen-free. That's why these interventions that are used in processing are so important, because we have to assume that that pathogen contamination occurs naturally, and we have to eliminate it during the processing of those foods so that when they're processed and packaged for consumers, they're safe.
Mm. I'm afraid there won't be time for question two, but David, I'm glad you got question number one. Gentlemen, thank you. It's been a fascinating article. Are you both of you encouraged that in 2013 and beyond our food will be substantially safer? Just a quick response. David?
I think that we're on the right road.
Okay.
And so, you know, we're certainly heading in the right direction with this.
James Marston?
And I totally agree, especially when it comes to foods that are produced in other countries. I think this is a major step forward.
Mm. Okay. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Our guests, James Marston, Professor of Food Safety and Security at Kansas State University, David Plunkett, Senior Staff Attorney for the Food Safety Program at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who produces this program, and thanks to all of you for your interest in your calls and emails. A reminder that even though the show is over, you can go to our Facebook page and comment. We like to read what people are thinking about the issues that we discussed, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Interesting hour coming up. You won't want to miss it.